morning, everyone. We're all gathered here today to honor and celebrate, pay tribute to our beloved Samuel Denhoff. And before we begin the service, if I can ask those of you who have a cell phone, if you can please at this point place it in the silent mode. I'll give you a moment to do that right now. Services today are being officiated by Rabbi Jerry Cutler.
My condolences, everyone, especially Sharon, Matthew, Melissa, Doug. I look for words that would help ease the pain of loss we're all going through, especially the family. I turned to our sages. There was a great sage who lived many years ago. His name was Ben Sira. And someone asked him if there was anything he could say that would help them after having lost someone close and dear. And Ben Sira said, "Fear not death. This is something we share with all who ever lived, with all who ever will be. Grieve for those who have passed on. Do not hide your grief. Do not restrain your mourning, but remember that continuing sorrow is worse than death. When the dead are at rest, let the memory rest. Be consoled when the soul departs. Death is better than a life of pain, eternal rest than constant sickness. And seek not to understand what is too difficult for you. Search not for what is hidden from you. Be not overoccupied with what is beyond you, for you, my friend, have been shown much more than you can ever understand." Why was he afflicted with this terrible, terrible disease? That incredible, fertile mind, so brilliant, so funny. And one day it stopped. We ask, we've looked into our scriptures, why do bad things happen to these incredible people? And we finally have an answer. They happen because they do. There is no other answer. So my dear friend Sam, as a drop of water in the sea, as a grain of sand on the shore, our few days in eternity, the good things would be limited. But a good reputation, a good name, Sam Denhoff, this will go on and on and on, and legendary in the annals of show business. It will endure forever. And forever in the lifetime of our people, our culture, our heritage, we go back some 4,000 years. During those years, if you're familiar with our history, we moved around a lot. Not that we wanted to. We're always being forced out of our homes, our habitats, sometimes at a moment's notice. And we'd have to grab our belongings and necessities, put it on a wagon, and start our travels from city to city, from town to town, from shtetl to shtetl. But at all times, we brought our books. In Hebrew, we're known as Am HaSefer, the people of the book, and our books have sustained us. Our books have... if that's the way he wants to play it, okay. And throughout all these years, our writings have kept us going. We read at this time the 23rd Psalm. We've chosen this because the author had his fights with God. We all do. One time or another, we get angry, we yell up to God, and Sharon and the family must have done that hundreds of times since he was afflicted. The author started to worship idols, and God came down to him, read him the riot act. And David recoiled, and he realized the error of his ways, and he sat and he wrote the 23rd Psalm as a reaffirmation of his love for God. So, if you've received this, hopefully you have. At the end of that pamphlet is the 23rd Psalm. May I ask you please to read it with me together. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He guideth me in straight paths for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou hast anointed my head with oil, and my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And thank you. Forever is, I don't know why he just doesn't lie still. Forever is a very long time. No one has lived forever. In Jewish parlance, this is our forever. And our physical being. And we hope and pray that during our lifetime, we will do something of consequence. Something that will not only help us, but help people around us. Don't just lie there like a clod, for God's sake. Do something. Enrich the world. Make it a better place in which to live. Sam made it a better place. He made it a happier place, that's for sure. And if you were in his company, you laughed. If you watched the shows on TV, you laughed. He gave so much enjoyment to literally millions of people throughout the world. That's a legacy. That's a sensational legacy to leave. And God bless him, Sam. Sam did it. And people still tune on and they see reruns and they still laugh. Well, you think about the shows he was on and you laugh. He brought a lot of merriment to our lives. He spent his time well. Ecclesiastes, while talking about time, the essence of time, the mechanics of time, wrote a sonnet some 2,000 years ago to everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under the heavens, a time to be born and sadly a time to die, a time to laugh, a time to cry. Time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to make people laugh. I had to insert that because he made time to make us laugh. And a time to make us cry, and he makes us cry now. A time to discard, a time to keep, a time to be silent. And yes, a time to speak. I must tell you, for those of you who want to speak, we invite you up here. Me lectern, Sue lectern. You can use it and speak, and God bless you, and let's all share. It's a good catharsis for all of us. to listen to wonderful words. So that will be in a few minutes. I think Matthew is going to speak first. Melissa is going to speak first. Not yet. After me. I don't have to tell you his biography. All of you know it. There was the obituary in today's paper. And it told of his beginnings. He was born in the old country in Brooklyn, New York. And we have quotes from Mr. Van Dyke. A real bon vivant, he said. Knew all the best restaurants. He said, you just don't make guys like that anymore. And you're right, Dick, you don't make guys like that anymore. They came out to California, wrote their first script for the Dick Van Dyke Show. And Sam described those years as a free pass to Disneyland for the rest of your life. That girl, that's where I first met him. I had just come out to California. I had a client on that girl. I before the rabbinet, was a personal manager. And I was so good at it, I had to become a rabbi. And I went there, I had my daughter, I remember, Milo. She was just a year or two old. And I was holding her, and someone said, wait a minute, Sam has to see this. Sam loves children. And Sam came running out. I had never met him. He came out, can I hold her? I said, you can take her home. Yeah, it's fine. So he was so tender and loving with my daughter. I said, this is a mensch. What a good guy. So I figured I could ask him something. And I said, listen, I'm thinking of starting a synagogue for show business people. Would you be of help to me? And he looked at me and he said, you know what? Go inside. There's a guy named Turtle Tab who's a professional Jew. And he'll help you. I went inside, and sure enough, Saul and Bernie as well, they gave me some money for prayer books, and we started Synagogue for the Performing Arts in 1972. I remember one other thing I was telling Doug at Doug's mother's funeral, Bernice's funeral. And Leslie got up to speak, and she told about her mother, and she said she had a great love for Doug and I. And he stood up. He said, I spent thousands of dollars on the education of my kids to go to school and speak well. And she says, Doug and I. Should be Doug and me. And he sat down. I wrote a play once called Cats and a Widow Gallagher. And Sam came down, regardless of the title. He just came down and I said, Sam, God, you honor me with your presence. Sam, I want you to be honest with me. I want you to tell me how you like the play, okay? If you have nothing good to say, don't speak to me. That was the last time I spoke to Sam. Needless to say, he was a great man, a great human being, a great credit to the industry. And as I said before, he will be missed, but he'll never be forgotten. Never, ever. And rest in peace, Sam. Amen. Melissa, please.
Hi, thank you all for coming. I was going to read this, but something interesting happened this morning. As you all know, I was quite a handful as a child growing up, and my dad and I had a very unique relationship. One, as much as I think my mom gave up at like maybe age 8 or 9 and waking me up, because I'm definitely not a morning person. So my dad and I all throughout school had a routine where he would wake me up and I wouldn't wake up, and then he'd go take a shower, and then he'd come back and wake me up again and I still wouldn't wake up, and then he'd send the gross stinky dog in to wake me up, and then finally I'd get up. So this morning I get up and I'm slow moving and I go to dry my hair, and of course the hairdryer blows up and starts sparking in my head. So to me that was my dad saying, come on, get a move on it, kind of like the light. And then we're in the car driving up and Luther Vandross came on with My Last Dance with My Father. So I thought it was kind of a special morning that I wanted to share. I don't know if I will ever meet someone I respected and loved as much as my father. He was very successful in his professional life, but he was also a terrific dad. He taught me what love means and how to be myself and how to enjoy life. He had high morals and values that I will strive for in my lifetime. I hold such great memories of our special times together, the laughter we shared that others didn't understand but us. I was his little girl, and I will always cherish our moments. He will be missed. So, Dad, you know that you're my hero. You're everything I wish I could be. I could fly higher than an eagle because you're the wind beneath my wings. So that's for you, Dad. There's a note from my dad's good friend, Wally Amos, who wished he could be here. He asked me to read this. And it is, I did not die. Do not stand by my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am a diamond glint of snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awake in the morning hush, I am the swift, uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the soft starshine at night. Do not stand by my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die.
Hi. I'm Matthew. Thank you all very much for coming. I don't have anything written down. As a lot of you well know, I've actually been taking care of my father for the last 2.5 years. A lot of it's been hard, but a lot of it's been great. We became best friends. Just, you know, his mind was not all there, but when it was, I saw the light in his eye and the smiles, then, and him saying, Matthew, I'm so glad you're here. And that's all I needed. Me and Lito, who's been an incredible part of our lives, he took care of my father with me. He's sitting right there behind me where I'm sitting, and he was amazing. My dad loved him. We took walks together, cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Just those little things to me made my world for the past 2.5 years, because like my sister says, he was my rock. I will never forget him. You know, like I said, we became very, very close the last 2.5 years, and I just would do anything for him, and I tried to. I had my moments that I'm not happy, but I think he is in a better place. I wish he could still be here, but I'm glad it was very painless. He, you know, went in his sleep. There was no emergency room. There was no paramedics. There was none of that. He died peacefully. I guess that's all I could wish for. I'm going to keep going on. That's what he would have wanted. And I'm going to make him proud of me. You know, I haven't been the easiest son to deal with either. Like my sister said, me and her have both been pretty much of a handful. We've made our mistakes, but he was always there to back us up and give us whatever we needed, as well as my mom. And all I can tell you is that I love him, and he loved me unconditionally. And thank you very much for coming.
Now I open it up. Ladies and gentlemen, is there anyone who
No, I don't think I need everybody. You can all hear me, huh?
Yes.
My name's Bob Hanley, and there are two things about Sam that I just wanted to mention at this time. When I got out of the Army, I came to Hollywood, read in Variety that Persky Denhoff were doing two shows, Big Eddie and the Montefuscos. And I read in the blurb that they did the Dick Van Dyke Show, and it was like unbelievable that I had the opportunity to meet them. So I snuck on the lot at CBS Radford, where their offices were, went to Audrey, who was the secretary, and I don't know where I got the guts. I felt as though I was the lion visiting the Wizard of Oz, you know, and I didn't even know what I was going to say. You know, my name is Bob Hanley. I'm an actor. Do you think I could meet Mr. Denhoff and Mr. Persky? And she said, well, do you have an appointment? No. And she said, well, why don't you just sit there? And I sat on the couch. She said, they're in a meeting, though. It's a writer's meeting. I don't know how long they're going to be. 45 minutes, an hour goes by. I'm sitting there. 50 guys, it seemed like, to me, come out of the room. Sam's there, and I can see her talking to him. And he turns to me. I don't know what he's going to say, but he says, come on in, kid. And I go into his office, and there were four Emmys up there. And he said, here, come on, can I get you some soda? And I was just floored. It was so classic Sam as a human being. And that was around 1974, I guess. And he treated me with that way throughout the years. I did warm-ups. That's one of the reasons why I raised my hand first, Rabbi. What is Sam? I'm doing the warm-ups for you again. So he was like that. He was avuncular to me. I loved him. It was something that even some of the people who are sitting here have been very nice to me starting out of my career, and I still feel like I'm that same kid in this business. So that's the man part. If I ever remember anything, I'll remember that. It's amazing how short phrases stick with you about what a person is. The other has to do with comedy. As years went by, I had an idea for a screenplay, and I went to Sam and I said, what do you think of this? He says, it's good. We wound up writing a screenplay, and I was like with my idol writing the screenplay. And one day, Sam was in a wine club at the time, and we had delivered wine, like an $800 bottle of wine that he was going to drink with some guys later that night. And I said, what are you, crazy? Anyhow, we're writing in this room, and Sam pours himself a glass of wine, and he lifts it up. Rabbi, help me out here if I don't say this correctly. But he said something like, Baruch, a toy, annoy. And I said to him, what does that mean, Sam? And he said something along the lines of, to you, Lord, we give you grace or honor, words to that effect. And I said, gee, that's very nice that you offer that up to God. And I said, you know, I'm Catholic, Sam. And I said, what we say is, bless us, O Lord, for these thy gifts, which we are about to receive from thy bounty through Christ our Lord. Amen. Sam says, same thing, only we leave out the distributor.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Mr. Shell.
Good to see you. I am Ronnie Shell, the noted comedian. And I didn't know I was going to be asked to speak, so my comments will be very brief. No, seriously, I don't have much to say. And I am unprepared, so I did want to say that I have known and knew Sam Denoff for 51 years. And it's been was a great 51 years. It started in about 1958 when I was working at the Crescendo up on the Sunset Strip with Francis Fay and the Modernaires, and I was getting a low $1,500 a week. And in those days, I guess it was pretty good, okay? So Sam and Bill came in to see me. Is Bill here today? He's not here? And Bill came back to me and said, "You're one of the finest talents I've ever seen, Ronnie." You're going to go a long way in this business. And don't you agree, Sam? And he said, "Yes, I do. Yes, I do. He's going to be great." And they kept their promise because later, while I was doing the Gomer Pyle show, which I played the part of Duke, making a paltry $2,500 a week, but in those days it was 39 weeks. So you can add it up for yourselves, okay? And they took me aside again, Bill, and said, "Ronnie, we're doing a show called That Girl, and we'd like you to play the agent, Harvey Peck." And I said, "Well, I'd like to. How much?" He said, "At least $3,500 a week." I said, "Fine, I'll take it." So I took it. And then shortly after that, he did CBS Follies. It was a special with Bill and Sam, and the co-star was Tony Curtis. I'll never forget. I went up to Tony Curtis. The very first day I went up to him and I said hi, and he said, "Me too." So then we did a show called Good Morning World, which I played the part of Larry Clark with some little chick named Goldie Hawn. And then, funny you asked. Five big ones. $5,000. And it was then that I, too, Rabbi Cutler, I wrote a script, sort of a spinoff called Duke Goes Navy. And I said to Sam, "Sam, you've got to be honest with me. I did write this. It was a takeoff on the Gomer Pyle show. And I said, "What do you think of it?" And he looked at me and said, "It's a piece of shit." Oh, you read it. So anyway, I went on to do several other shows, which I always really thank Billy and Sammy for allowing me to work with them. And I loved Sammy because he was such a great guy. And he paid to me a compliment that I think came from his heart, and he once said, "Ronnie, above all, you're a pain in the ass sometime, but you have a great Jewish soul." And I really love that he remembered that. And you know, I think you can hope and you can wait, but I don't think a Sammy Denoff will be coming around this way anytime soon. So I love you, Sammy.
If you made all that money, I should have been your manager. I wouldn't have gone into the rabbinate.
I'm what's left of Dick Van Dyke. You know, what I can't get around my head is that it's 50 years since Sammy and the rest of us started having the time of our lives. When I first met Sam, I got the impression he wanted people to see him as a curmudgeon, as a cynic. You know, he's cynical about people, cynical about the world. It's all a tale told by an idiot. But it was a facade that just didn't work for Sam because he was such a softy inside. And he was a man about town. You know, he had 100 hats, always had the best cigars, the best wine, the best restaurants. During the beginning of the show, his first marriage was just kind of dissolving. We'd be in rehearsal, and the phone, they say, a phone call for you, Sam. He'd say, excuse me. And you go in the office, and we hear screaming. But then, of course, he was very happily married after that. He used to come to the dress rehearsals just before the show. And, of course, all the writers would come down, and Sam would take that cigar out of his mouth and say, boring! He was also a great songwriter. One of his favorite songs was, I'm in love with Attila the Hun, Attila the Hun, Attila the Hun, he'll pillage a village and kill everyone. I love Attila the Hun. One of his better known was, but the side of him that I love, we did a show about a birthday party where I had to be a clown and entertain, and he wrote a little song that sticks with me to this day. When I grow up, I want to be a very famous clown and have the people laugh at me when the circus comes to town. I'll make them glad when they are sad. I'll chase away its frown. Next year, when I am fully grown and the circus comes to town. I miss him. We'll all miss that man. There was nobody like Sam. Thank you.
My name is Warren Berlinger. I work with Sam in a show called The Funny Side many, many moons ago in the 70s. And I just wanted to relate to you about one incident that happened, which I enjoy and remember, and I'm very happy about it. Gene Kelly was our star. We had Burt Mustin and Queenie Smith and a bunch of other people. And let me set the scene for you. I'm in court with Dick Clare. He accused me of killing his goldfish. And I'm defending myself. And we're getting some good laughs. I lean over the table and I deliver a line. The table separates Dick and myself. And when I leaned over, we get a laugh. And I thought that was pretty good. An actor doing comedy, getting a laugh, not bad. Then I have another line that I delivered. And we get a bigger laugh. I bent over the table, bigger laugh. I was saying to myself, boy, we're doing pretty good here. And then I leaned over the table again. And we got hysterical laugh. And I'm saying to myself, something's wrong here. Something's definitely wrong. I'm getting big, big laughs here. It's not that funny. Well, I bent down, I looked down and my fly was open. Well, that's not the funny part. What Sam did was he urged the director at the time to have a close-up of my fly. So every time I bent over, the fly was bigger. And that's why we got the big laughs. Sam, I just want to tell you that thank you very much for a wonderful memory and a lot of fun. And let me just say that after that episode, he came over to me and he said, How about that writing?
My name is Mark Scheffler, and I've known Sam since 1985. And from 1988 until 1994, we were writing partners and were with each other nearly every day. When kids grow up, we have heroes. Some kids, cowboys, some kids, astronauts, some kids, baseball players. Being a little Jewish kid from Pittsburgh, I knew I was never going to be any of those. The only chance I had was to be funny. And my heroes were television comedy writers. And chief among them were the writers of my favorite show at the time, The Dick Van Dyke Show. And prominent among them was the name Sam Denhoff. Years later, after I came to Hollywood and I started working, through Brandon Tartikoff, I met Sam, and we became friends. And then years later, we started working together. My first, one of my first moments of Sam being Sam was sitting in our office, and I had walked in, and he said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, my wife and I are thinking about having another," and then the phone rang. And he said, "Give me a second," and he picked up the phone. And he said, "Oh, hi, Doug." "What? How much? Have you talked to your mother?" "She said to call me." "Okay, I'll call Maury and it'll happen. Okay, bye." So he said, "Mark, what were you saying?" I said, "Nothing, Jan and I, you know, we have Madison and Jackson and we're thinking about," and then the phone rang again. And "Leslie? Yeah, listen, I'm kind of, what? How much? Have you talked to your mother?" "Of course, she said call me." "Okay, I'll call Maury." And he said, "I'm sorry, I just family stuff, you know. I said, "Well, you know, Jan and I, we're, you know, we have," and the phone rang again. And it was Melissa. And he said, "Hi, Melissa. I know you talked to your mother. She said, call me. I'll call Maury. I got to go." And then he said to me, "Now, what did you want to say?" I said, "Nah, not important." Last year, I had the most interesting job of my life. I was hired to go to Cuba and develop and executive produce the first situation comedy pilot ever made in Cuba. And when they wanted a Spanish-speaking Jew who knew television, and I'm those things. So I went to Cuba, and there I was in the land of Fidel, and I'm working with these people who speak no English, who had never made a sitcom before, who had never shot a multi-camera show before. And every step along the way, I had Sam's voice in my ear telling me what to do. And it was in Spanish. And I kept saying to myself, "Sam, I didn't know you spoke Spanish." And he said, "I don't." And I sat there and I smoked great cigars and I drank great Cuban rum. And every time I made a decision, I would ask Sam if it was right. And in his Spanish, he would tell me, "Keed, you got to do what you feel." And I would say, "Thank you." So, Sam, I love you. And thank you for everything you gave me.
Hi, Hi, my name is Stephen Leeds. I've been Maddie's best friend since we were 5 years old. And I think I have a right to be speaking right now. I am a member of the Writers Guild. So I'm probably not as funny as anybody in this room, except for Ronnie. But well, I also grew up with Ronnie's son, Greg. I wanted to just talk about, most everybody that's spoken so far has talked about Sam before, you know, Sam when he was in, you know, working and younger, and I've known Sam since a little bit past that part of his life, and I knew him from the perspective of somebody about this tall, and I just wanted to, you know, say a couple things about just some of the memories that, trying to think of funny stories, but instead what kept coming up was, like, just iconic details about Sam, and so I'll just run through a couple of them. Amazing hat collection, like the greatest hat collection that anybody could ever have. And he didn't just have a great hat collection; he really loved to, like, go to the front door where there was the hats hanging up on the rack and sort of decide which hat he was going to wear. And then when he'd come home, he'd always put the hat back, and it was just a part of who he was. Paddle tennis on Sundays. The Bentley, for us kids, it was like, why is the steering wheel over there? I don't. Little League games, hearing him in the stands making jokes. All the parents always liked to go trick or treating with Sam because while we were off getting candy, he was making them all laugh, telling stories. My dad in particular. Cigars, television behind the mirror, which we thought was pretty tricky.
That's mom.
And just always ready to say something funny and make you feel welcome. But the one thing I want to say is that, you know, Maddie came up here and spoke very beautifully and eloquently, and but he also mentioned that he's had, you know, he's been a handful for his parents. But I want to set the record straight on that. You know, all kids go through things that are difficult. But you know, Matt is, of all the people I know, and I've got a ton of friends that I've had for over 30 years. Of all the people I know, Matt has the biggest heart. He's like, sorry. He's the sweetest person in his heart of anybody I know. And to Sam being 50% of the parent team that made a kid with such a huge heart. I'm gonna miss you, Sam. Love you.
Will Manis. I first met Sam Denhoff back in 1949. This was at Adelphi College in Garden City, Long Island. Adelphi had been an all-girls school, the kind you settled for if you couldn't make the grade at Vassar or Sarah Lawrence. Adelphi went co-ed right after World War II, and to put the change on the map, the college started a sports program and gave out a few dozen football and basketball scholarships. Adelphi also opened its doors to a bunch of guys on the GI Bill. Thus, the 500 girls on campus were joined by about 100 boys, most of whom were either shell-shocked vets or roughhouse jocks whose demeanor could best be described as Neanderthal. Standing out like a lily on a dung heap was Sam Denhoff. I first encountered him in the Quonset Hut student lounge, where, surrounded by largely hungover riffraff, he sat blithely playing pop and show tunes on the piano. Sam's musical gifts were matched by his wit and writing talent. He quickly became the star of the theater department, writing songs and skits for a musical review. Sam stayed at Adelphi for only a couple of years, but we saw each other from time to time after that, mostly at the home of the Lyota family in Sheepshead Bay, where every Sunday, Mama Lyota cooked these stupendous Italian meals. Much music was played here as well, with Sam on piano, Papa Lyota on mandolin, Chuck Lyota and his cousin Vince Colacci, both fellow Adelphians, on vocals and guitar. I met my wife Mavis at one of those soirees. Chuck, Vince, and another Adelphi alum, Herbie Bick, later formed a trio, Little Dane and Mason, that began to fight and claw its way up the flanks of the showbiz mountain. They saw a lot of more of Sam than I did in those days, the late 1950s, if only because he was climbing the same mountain himself, first in cabaret circles, then as a radio writer, then in television with his writing partner, Billy Persky. Flash forward 20 years. After a long absence from the USA, I reconnected with Sam at his house in Brentwood, which came equipped with swimming pool and paddle tennis court. Sam had no use for the pool. "I don't mess with nature," was his explanation. But the court he put to good use. There was a game at his place every Sunday morning for 2 decades, and one of the best players out there was Sam himself. Big and strong, he could be counted on to perform skillfully and winningly. He was also, like the rest of us, a vociferous competitor. The games got so loud and profane that Sam's wife, Sharon, would sometimes pop her head out and cry, "What's all the screaming and cursing about? It's only a game, for God's sakes." Sam also put out coffee and bagels for everyone. He was also good for several good jokes each week, and when the games were done, he might even pour a glass of fine French wine. Taking part in those Sunday games were several old Adelphi cronies like Chuck Lyota and Cy Litvinoff, plus the comedy writer Larry Cohn, the actors Bob Hogan and Alan Oppenheimer, the TV director Freddie Levinson, the producer Harry Blum, and of course Sam's sons, Doug and Matt. Attrition, injuries, and old age whittled down the cast of characters at Shea Denoff. Sam himself was one of the players who eventually had to drop out, but he insisted that the game go on without him. In recent years, a whole new bunch of players, most of them on the bright side of 40, have been keeping the paddle tennis tradition alive. As the last man standing from the old crew, I look forward to seeing Sam and talking with him every Sunday. Sam, as you all know, was not just funny, but bright and knowledgeable about the world, life, and people. He was also one of the most decent, caring, and generous men I've ever met, always willing to do a favor, put himself out for you. In recent years, as the darkness and horror of dementia took hold of him, it was no longer possible to sit and chat with him, enjoy his company. It was such a loss, losing that time with him, seeing him slowly fade away like that. Now he's gone, and all we can do is try and honor him, remember him for the wonderful, vital, and talented person as he was, as Rabbi Cutler said, an honest to God mensch.
Gather, there's another funeral waiting. If anyone knows me, my name is Rick Middleman. Anyone knows me, I run at the sight of a microphone or a podium, so bear with me. Obviously, I don't have the Ronnie Shell gene. I've known Sam since 1944. He was in the 10th grade, I was in the 9th grade. We were among a large group of friends. Sammy was always the spark plug, whether it was figuring out where to play poker, playing softball, taking a ride somewhere, going out for a movie and a Sunday afterwards. Sammy was always the spark plug. Random memories come to mind, and I'll make it brief, just a few. Eventually, Sam's family moved into the same apartment house that I had lived in, and Sam's mom was a terrific cook. But he always came up for dessert at my house because my mother made better desserts. And Sam, the piano man, we decided in high school to collaborate, and I would do lyrics, and Sam would do the music. So I came up with what I thought were beautiful lyrics, a song called Sunlight Fills My Room, and Sam transposed it into Garbage Fills My Room. again, senior in high school, we decided to do our own candid camera thing. We came up with an idea. Sam's father, Harry, had this big old square Jeep, the large windows, and we decided to see what would happen if Sam would drive the Jeep into New York, and I would be lying in the back seat, face up, my mouth taped, and my hands and feet tied. And this was in the days when New York police had gravy stains on their uniform and, and didn't shoot at anything that moved. So we wanted to see if we'd get any reaction. Well, we drove around Manhattan for about an hour, stopping at all stoplights, taking our time, pedestrians. Not a single person noticed that I was lying on the floor. Sam was also, pardon me, the word bon vivant came up in the obituary, today's paper, and I also used that expression that he was the town bon vivant while working at a haberdashery store run by a big German with a thick accent named Tex. And Tex loved Sam like a son and wanted Sam to take over the store and run the haberdashery business. But Sam had bigger ideas. And I was present when Sam's entry into show business, no one knows this probably, but Sam's first entry into show business was working at Klein's department store, if anyone remembers that, I believe down on Union Square years and years ago. And he had a little chair and table in the mezzanine between the first and the second floor, which was filled with merchandise, boxes of everything imaginable. And Sam had a microphone and a table and a little phonograph. And every once in a while, he would stop the music and he would say, ladies, for a half hour only, brassieres on sale, half price. And they put the music back on. And that was Sam's first entry to show business. And a sentimental thing for me was sitting with Sammy in a hospital in uptown Manhattan, waiting for little Dougie to be born, now Big Dougie. That was 54 years ago. And Sam was so excited and so happy. I don't recall Sam ever being happier at that time. Of course, I wasn't there for Matthew's birth, but that was Sam. And it was a wonderful, and then when I moved to California, Sam followed just to check out California. I believe he and Billy Persky had a job offer writing for the Steve Allen Show on Channel 5, KTLA. It wasn't the later Steve Allen Show. And he came to live with me. And we had more fun when he stayed with me until he divorced me and married Sam Bobrick. And the rest is history. My heart goes out to Sharon, Melissa, Matthew. Sam was a warm, funny, good-natured despite his frequent use of the words, bullshit, bullshit. He was super talented, and most of all, a major force in the lives of all of us who were lucky enough to know the one and only Sammy Denham.
I want to thank everyone who has come up to speak. The light just went on for you, Doug. For our last speaker, I'd like to introduce my friend, Doug Denhoff, please.
Thanks. Uncle Ricky, I have to disagree. Grandma's cheesecake and her mandelbrot, pretty awesome. I'll make you some. I have the recipe, so we'll make that happen. Oi! Thank you all for coming. He did this smart, at least. He avoided Carmageddon. Maybe this was his way to a thing. We'll figure it out. Anyway, I love you all for coming, and most of you have known me all my life. Some of my friends I've known as long as Ricky and Duck and David Yarnell have known Dad. I'm going to read a few things from some people who couldn't make it today first. They're very brief. First, from Saul Turtletaub. It was my 50th birthday in 1982, and my wife Shirley surprised me by renting an RV. A Jew in an RV? Filling it with lunch and my regular poker game friends Ron Clark, Gary Collins, Joe Nahr, and Sam Denoff. As we ate the goodies from Nate and Al's, the driver took us to a casino in the City of Commerce, where we commandeered a table and began our first professional poker game. Shortly, the house dealer recognized Gary and told him and all of us he used to be in the business too. We asked what he did, and he told us he was a reader for Burt Reynolds at Universal. Ron said, "Sounds like a good job. Why did you leave?" And the dealer said, "One of my kids got hooked on drugs, my single daughter got pregnant, my wife had a nervous breakdown, and I ran out of money and became an alcoholic." And Sam, very quietly, guessed, "And then things started to go bad." I knew and loved Sammy for 53 years. I will greatly miss him, as will our business. Of Saul Turtletaub. What else we got here? Very brief. I'm sure you may have seen it in the Times obit, but Marlowe, with whom he didn't always have the smoothest loving relationship. Well, no, it wasn't always smooth. It was always loving on both sides. And she wrote, "Sam was my greatest convert to feminism as part of our great adventure, bringing the first single girl to television. We had to buck the system, the networks, and we all did it together. He liked to think of himself as the unsentimental guy on the staff, but the lyrics he wrote for our theme song belied his self-description. Diamonds, daisies, snowflakes, that girl. She's tinsel on a tree. She's everything that every girl should be." Pretty romantic and sentimental, don't you agree? Thanks, Marlo. That was beautiful. My sister, Leslie, who lives in London. She left her horse there, much to everybody's chagrin, but she loved that horse, and Sammy's gone now. Name the horse Sammy. But she wishes she could be here, and she wrote, first of all, she contributed the music Fire and Rain and the My Favorite Things. I picked the Brubeck arrangement because all I had on iTunes, but she loved those songs and loved when he sang My Favorite Things to her. She said, "My father was a great man. He was my dad. He never tried to be my buddy. He was my father in the truest sense of the word. He taught me what he believed was the right way to live and passed on to me his love of life, of truth, and of laughter. He took the responsibility of raising us seriously, but he also showed me that you can be an adult without losing the ability to be silly. In fact, Dad had being silly and funny down to a fine art, and he shared that art with millions of people. But I always felt that there was a special part of himself that was reserved just for me, and I will miss that so very much. I will miss him every day, and yet, if any of what I believe to be true about the nature of the soul, then he is always with me, and he knows how very much I love him. I truly wish that I could be there today to share with you, but sadly there was not enough time to get the travel documents and fly home in time. However, in the same way that I'll always carry a part of my poppy with me, I am with all of you too. Thank you for sharing in my dad's life, as his family and friends were the most important things in the world to him. And thank you also for coming to say goodbye to my dad. I love you, Poppy." And then her husband wrote, her husband Peter, a Brit, "When Sam came to England for my wedding to his daughter Leslie, we booked him into a stereotypical English country hotel complete with thatched roof. Sam was delighted with the chocolate box setting, but unfortunately had to search for a hotel elsewhere. The problem was the beds were too short, leaving his ankles and feet hanging over the end of the bed. Sam was, as you probably know, a very big man, not just in stature, but in heart, and he had a sense of humor to match. Like one of the characters he wrote for Harry the Sasquatch, Harry and the Hendersons, Sam left a big footprint on our lives. I will miss his gentle, kind soul. All right, that's it. That's from Peter. Now, so many scripts. Uncle Persky is very sad to not be here today. He was in Michigas. Good Michigas, though. He's finally gotten his life together and found a wife for more than 8 minutes, and he's very happy. And Joanna is wonderful. They live 6 blocks from me on Lexington and 67th Street. We see each other all the time, and I love him very much. And he wrote this. In 20 years, there were a million stories, but for some reason, this comes to mind. The time Sammy saved my life, or at least my ass. In 1962, we got a job writing a show for ABC to introduce their new fall lineup to the affiliates at a meeting in Chicago. It was a full musical review with original songs, sketches, and monologues featuring all their stars, which that year included Gene Kelly, who was in Going My Way, Gene Barry in Burke's Law, Chuck Connors in The Rifleman, Ozzie and Harriet, and Jack Palance in The Greatest Show on Earth. The performance was on Saturday afternoon with the rehearsal the Friday before. Everyone was satisfied the jokes we had written for them. Everyone but film menace Jack Palance, who had just arrived after a 24-hour sleepless journey from Italy, where he had just finished a film in which he killed about a million people. Since he was not famous for his sense of humor, we had written a nice short speech about how he loved the circus and was thrilled to be doing the show. We were having a drink after the rehearsal when his agent came over to ask why Jack didn't have a joke. We explained that the show was a drama, and he's a serious actor, so a joke didn't seem quite right. He returned 10 minutes later with these chilling words, "Jack wants a joke. Come to his room and write one." Jack Palance was frightening under any circumstances, but grouchy from no sleep after killing a million people, he was terrifying. After about 100 jokes, none of which elicited the slightest indication of amusing him, he was starting to become annoyed. Picture being trapped in room with him when he's not happy. Finally, Sam, bless him, said something, and Jack went, "Har!" A kind of snarl, as if he was about to attack. "He likes it," translated his agent as Jack let out another, "Har!" Since there's no guarantee that any joke will work, and concerned that if he didn't get a laugh at the show that might come after us, we told him we were going to give him a saver. Looking like a much ice-bloodied gunfighter character from Shane, he asked why the joke wouldn't get a laugh. Sammy assured him that it would, but just in case, the saver definitely would. "If you want to see the greatest show on earth, just watch what I do to the guys who told me it was funny." We got a "hur-hur" and escaped to the bar. I'm sure you would like to know the joke, but frankly, I don't remember it. I do remember it did get a huge laugh, probably because no one expected Jack Palance to tell a joke. He was stunned, and when the laughter died down, he said, "If you want to see the greatest show on earth, watch what I do to the guy who told me it was funny." At which point, the audience was also stunned, and he walked off the stage in a daze. We heard he was looking for us later, and since we weren't sure why, we hid in our rooms. Really smart. Persky and Denoff was a wonderful time in my life, and I will miss him. Oh. I don't know if anybody still miss his sport coats, though. He had rather questionable taste in clothing. He did love cigars. I have an empty ashtray because, like smart people, he quit smoking quite a number of years ago. But the smell will always be with me, and anytime I smell a guy walking down the street in Manhattan, I work with Jerry Zaks once in a while, and Jerry and I will stand on the street and smoke a Monty 2 or something, and it's very Proustian. It was quite lovely, though. And he loved his crossword puzzles, which, like his big ass, I inherited his love for crossword puzzles. Some of you in the room, ladies who know me a bit more intimately, know how much I love the crossword puzzles in that small room in the house where I might stay for 30, 40, 50 minutes working on the puzzle. But it's a good thing to be son of Sam. And I will miss him very much and love him very much, and I'm very glad that all of this is around. His disease was horrible, and I think it's okay that I share that because it's somewhat hereditary. I'm a little nervous myself, And his doctor is a wonderful doctor at UCLA named John Ringman, who has Alzheimer's Disease Foundation. And we're supporting that. Dad actually donated his brain. We donated his brain and all the jokes contained therein. I wonder if Bob Hope will try and get a hold of it. When I talked to the doctor, I felt pretty good that they were going to really make some great strides in this, and I hope you will support the research they're doing at UCLA, and I have information about all of that if you want to. My friend Gloria Palter, who is the woman who introduced my father to my mother, his first wife, I thank you for that, because I don't know who I'd be son of if it weren't for you. He did love songwriting, and he wrote this beautiful song with his friend Jim Haynes, Jimbo, with whom he lived on Charles Street in the Village. And he did, if you read the obit, he always wanted Sinatra or Perry Como to perform it. I'm none of those people, but I think it's time it got some public airplay. So I'm going to try and work through this. It was originally called Sleep Warm, which I hope he will. He hated being cold. Now the moon is rising, making diamonds in the snow. Every star is sizing up the village down below. Once again it seems I surrender to my dreams of Christmas long ago. How my heart remembers every sound and every sight. Frosty cold December winds that bluster through the night. Little carolers wrapped in woolens to their ears. That's Christmas long ago. Bridge. How clearly I recall that shining evergreen. Don't think I've ever seen so tall a tree. The popcorn that we strung and the mistletoe we hung are memories so close to me. And when the dawn is bringing on a lovely Christmas day, sleigh bells will be ringing on an old familiar sleigh. Hope it stops for me, takes me home again to see my Christmas long ago. Sleep warm, Papa. I love you.
Doug, thank you. Don't ever cast yourself in a musical. May I ask you please to rise? Emalei Rachamim Shochein Bamromim, exalted and compassionate God. Hamatzei Menucha Nachana Tachas Kanfei Hashchina, we ask that you grant infinite rest in your sheltering presence. The Malos Kadoshim Utahorin Kazora Kimazhidim, infinite rest among the holy and pure to the soul of Samuel Denhoff, who's gone to his eternal home. Merciful God, we ask that Sam find perfect peace in your eternal embrace. May his soul be bound up in the bond of life. Adonai Natan, Adonai Lakach, Yihi Shem Adonai Mevorach. God had given, and now in the wings of angels, God takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of Samuel Denhoff. For Sam and the Lord are one. May he rest in eternal peace, and let us all say, Amen. Please be seated.
Thank you, Rabbi. And on behalf of the family, I'd like to thank you all for being here today. And with your attendance, you've all performed a big mitzvah, an act of loving kindness and providing comfort and support to the family during this difficult time for them. And services for Sam will continue and conclude at Cripside at the Judea Mausoleum. It's relatively close by, so those of you who are able to walk, It's right down the road and then up the drive, and you'll see the green tent. And after the service, you're all invited back to the family home in Los Angeles, and there are maps available for those of you who do not know how to get there. They're available to you as you're exiting the chapel. And at this time, I'd like to call up those individuals who have been honored to serve as active casket bearers. When I call your name, if you can please come forward. Matthew Denoff. Douglas Denoff. Will Manis. George Shapiro. Rick Middleman. And David Yarnell.
David, are you okay? Because Howard can do it. You all right?
I'd also like to call up those individuals who will be following behind the casket as honorary casket bearers. And they are Cy Litvinoff and Chuck Leota.
Not here.
Okay. At this point, we will be leading the casket down the center aisle. I ask the family follow immediately behind with the rabbi, and everyone else follow immediately behind them. At this point, if I can ask everyone to please rise.